Let's turn to, well, keep Psalm 49 open then in our Bible. During the silly season, when a lot of our people go on holiday and we have visitors coming here, it's difficult to do a consecutive series of sermons, so I thought we'd dip into a few psalms during the month of August and this last Sunday of July. And I picked Psalm 49 this morning. Most of the psalms are addressed to God. They're prayers or they're praises. They're addressed by man to God. This psalm is unusual. It's not a prayer. It's actually addressed by the psalmist to us and not to God. Now, it's not unique in that respect. The first two psalms, for instance, are actually exactly the same. They're not prayers to God. They are addressed to the reader. They're known as wisdom psalms. They offer instruction to man rather than praise or prayer to God. So this is one of the wisdom psalms. And the psalmist is trying to tell us how to live. He's trying to teach us wisdom. And he uses this psalm to do it. Now it's clear from the first four verses of the psalm that the psalmist thinks that what he has to say is very important. He addresses, verse 1, not just his fellow Israelites, but he addresses the whole world. Again, this is very unusual for the Old Testament. It's very unusual for the psalm. This psalm is addressed to the whole of mankind. Verse 1, hear this, all you peoples. Listen, all who live in this world. So the psalmist wants everybody to hear what he's got to say in this psalm. It's something that absolutely everyone needs to hear, regardless of their rank, regardless of their status. Verse 2, both low and high, rich and poor alike, absolutely everybody, no exceptions, should listen to the message of this psalm. And the psalmist is passionate about what he's got to say. It comes from his heart. Verse 3, my mouth will speak words of wisdom, the utterance from my heart will give understanding. He even sets it to music to help us remember it. And he accompanies it with the equivalent of his guitar, his harp. Verse 4, I will turn my ear to a proverb, with the harp I will expound my riddle. And if we listen to what he says, he tells us that it will result in wisdom and understanding. Verse 3, my mouth will speak words of wisdom, the utterance from my heart will give understanding. Wisdom and understanding here mean insight into reality. He's going to teach us how to live. If we listen to the message of this psalm, it will be an important lesson in how to live. That's what wisdom, that's what understanding means in the Old Testament. So he's trying to arouse people from their lethargy and their indifference and their foolishness, and he's trying to get them to listen to a truth which he regards as being tremendously important. And the implication is, of course, that people need to be aroused, they need to be awakened, because there's every likelihood that they will go through their lives and miss this truth unless their attention is not grabbed. So that's what he's trying to do in the first four verses of this psalm. He really wants everybody to listen to what he's got to say in this psalm, and that includes you. It includes this whole congregation this morning. We need to listen to what the psalmist wants to teach us in this psalm. Matthew Henry says, we seldom meet with an introduction more solemn than this is. Okay, so we've looked at the first four verses, the introduction to the psalm, where he grabs our attention. Well then, what is it? What is this insight? What is this truth that the psalmist is so anxious to get across and which people are so reluctant to hear. It's actually a very obvious truth. It's a blindingly obvious truth. And yet it's a truth which is constantly ignored. And the truth that he wants us to hear is this: the utter uselessness of riches in the light of the universal and inevitable fact of death. Now this is blindingly obvious. And yet it's something that everyone needs to be reminded of constantly, rich and poor alike. The rich because of a wrong delight in riches, and the poor because of a wrong desire for riches. You can be obsessed with riches whether you're rich or poor. If you're rich, you can be delighting in them. If you're poor, you can be desiring them. And the psalmist is telling us that it's all a complete waste of time in the light of the inevitable fact of death. Now let's see what the psalmist has to say then about this subject. It seems that he's a powerless person. He's surrounded by wealthy, powerful oppressors who seem to be giving him a bad time. He talks in verse 5 about evil days. Why should I fear when evil days come, when wicked deceivers surround me? These rich people are deceivers. They've probably obtained their wealth in some underhand way, probably at the expense of the psalmist and others. They're Robert Maxwell types. Can you remember Robert Maxwell, the big man with the big cigar? And he made lots of money by making lots of ordinary people much poorer than they would have been otherwise. And the psalmist is surrounded by people like that. And he is tempted to be afraid of them. Verse 5, why should I fear? He is tempted to be overawed and overimpressed by them. Verse 16, do not be overawed when a man grows rich. And these proud, powerful, confident people are trusting in their wealth and they're boasting of their great riches. And they're getting richer and richer, probably at his expense. Now in most countries of the world, today even, and throughout history, there has been no such thing as what we call today the middle class. You were either very rich or you were very poor. And in a situation like that, if you're very rich, it's almost certain that you got your riches wrongly, at the expense of the very poor. And there are countries like that today, where there are very, very rich people who are getting richer and richer and richer, and there are very, very poor people, and there's hardly anybody in between. And that's the kind of situation that the psalmist is writing from. And he is one of the poor people. And he is thinking about these very, very rich people who are getting very, very rich at the expense of the very, very poor. These people lived in splendor, verse 16. Do not be overawed when a man grows rich, when the splendor of his house increases. They're living in splendor. They're surrounded by hangers-on, verse 13. This is the fate of those who trust in themselves and of their followers who approve their sayings. There's always lots of hangers-on when you think of people like this. Verse 18, men praise you when you prosper. Men praise you when you prosper. These are the people who get invited onto the chat shows on the television. And everybody admires and envies their glamorous lives. These are the celebrities of the day. And the psalmist is a non-entity compared to them. And he is tempted to be afraid of them. He is tempted to be overawed by them. He is tempted perhaps even to be envious sometimes of them. That's what Psalm 37 certainly teaches, which is quite a similar psalm to Psalm 49. And there the psalmist is even tempted to be envious of these powerful, rich, glamorous people. And they're giving him a really bad time. But he says to himself in verse 5, why should I fear when evil days come, when wicked deceivers surround me? And he says to us, and he says to his readers in verse 16, do not be overawed when a man grows rich. So, you're getting the message, you're getting the picture. He's an ordinary poor chap, surrounded by very glamorous, confident, powerful, wealthy people who can give ordinary people a very bad time if they decide to, or if they take a dislike to you. But he's saying, don't be impressed by them, and don't be afraid of them. Why not? Why not? Well, because of the very simple and very obvious fact that these people are dying people. They are nowhere near as powerful as they seem. And faced by death, they are as powerless and as insecure as everyone else. They imagine, says the psalmist, that they're in control. They imagine that they're the masters of their own fate. The reality is that they're like a flock of sheep being led to the slaughterhouse. Verse 14. Like sheep, they are destined for the grave. And death will feed on them. They are fodder for death to feed on. The psalmist pictures death as a hungry, insatiable monster who can never get enough to eat. And he feeds on people. I read in the paper this week of a pensioner down south somewhere who has had a sign on his front door for 31 years, my dog feeds on Jehovah's Witnesses. And he's been asked to take it down because in these days of religious hatred laws, somebody might be upset. If I was a Jehovah's Witness, I'd be highly amused by that, I have to say. Well, death. He's like that man's dog who feeds on Jehovah's Witnesses. Only he doesn't just feed on Jehovah's Witnesses, he feeds on everybody. Death is an insatiable monster that feeds on everybody. Everybody gets gobbled up by death, including rich people. They trust, they boast in their wealth, verse 6. Those who trust in their wealth and boast of their great riches. But in the end, it will prove unworthy of their trust. It will let them down. Death shows absolutely no respect for wealth or power. Death is simply not impressed by wealth. Look at verses 7 to 9. No man can redeem the life of another or give to God a ransom for him. The ransom for a life is costly. No payment is ever enough that he should live on forever and not see decay. In other words, the psalmist is saying, people here, these people are used to buying themselves out of trouble, but they can't buy themselves out of death. No ransom is big enough for death to accept. You're familiar with the idea of redemption and the idea of the ransom. In the Old Testament, if you got into really big trouble, for instance, if you were taken captive in war, or perhaps you were sentenced to death for negligence, there was no way out if you were sentenced to death for deliberate murder, but if you were sentenced to death for negligence which caused the death of somebody, if you had the money, you could pay a price, or a wealthy relative could pay the price, could pay a ransom, and your money would release you from captivity or from that death sentence. Money talks. So if you or your relative had enough money, you could usually get yourself out of most situations of trouble. You could usually come to some arrangement. You could get your wallet out and you could say, I'm sure we can come to some arrangement. But the psalmist says there's no ransom, there's no price that death is going to be impressed by, that death will be accept. Death will accept. Death will accept no bribe. As one writer puts it, though in this life money talks, at the end its bid falls on deaf ears. And so when it comes to death, the rich man is no better off at all than the poor man. And this is just such a blindingly obvious fact, isn't it? We shouldn't really need to be reminded of it. It's so blindingly, glaringly obvious. Verse 10. All can see that wise men die, the foolish and the senseless alike, and leave their wealth to others. It's an absolutely obvious truth. And yet so few take it to heart. Most people still spend their lives acquiring and amassing wealth, or trying to acquire or amass wealth, or worrying about their failure to acquire or amass wealth. That sums up most people's lives. And hence the impassioned plea of verses 1 to 4. Listen, all the people of the world, all you peoples, listen, all who live in this world, low and high, rich and poor alike. I want to get your attention to this blindingly obvious fact that at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how rich you are, you're going to die. And your end will be the same as that of the poor man. Now, one thing that rich people invest a lot of their money in is their homes, their property. That is the great status symbol, the sort of house you live in. And so the psalmist talks about their splendid houses, verse 16. Do not be overawed when a man grows rich, when the splendor of his house increases. And he talks about people who've become great landowners, and they've had houses and palaces and lands named after them. Verse 11. They had named lands after themselves. So there are people who are so rich that they died hundreds of years ago, and yet we still visit their palaces. Somerset House. That's where the Duke of Somerset lived back in Tudor times. Somerset House. Buckingham Palace. Charles I, I think, or was it Charles II? Great pal, Buckingham. The Duke of Buckingham built Buckingham Palace. And these great palaces are named after these people. Parr Street. Named, for the sake of visitors who aren't aware of this, after Catherine Parr, who was supposed to have been born in Kendal, but sadly probably wasn't. And these people name their houses, they name their lands after themselves. And they've got splendid dwellings. But, says the psalmist, these people, their final dwelling will be exactly the same as that of the poor person. Their permanent final address will be the grave. The one permanent piece of real estate that they will possess forever will be the same as everybody else's. 6 foot of earth. A grave. And the best that their money can do will be to purchase perhaps a more expensive sepulchre or a more ornate gravestone. Or maybe if they're really powerful and really important, they'll lie in state. Well, what a big deal. They'll lie in state and they'll have 4 or 5 soldiers guarding their coffin for a night or two and people walking past and looking at the coffin, which is probably exactly the same, or pretty well exactly the same, as everybody else's. And then they'll be buried in Westminster Abbey. Westminster Abbey, I nearly said Westminster Chapel. Then they'll be buried in Westminster Abbey or St. Paul or someone like that. No one summed it up better than the poet Thomas Gray in that great elegy in a churchyard. The boast of heraldry, the pomp of power, and all that beauty, all that wealth e'er gave, await alike the inevitable hour. The paths of glory lead but to the grave. So, the psalmist says, don't be impressed by the Robert Maxwells of this world. Don't be impressed by them. Don't be afraid of them. Don't be overawed by them. A man who has riches and nothing else is no better than a poor man. In fact, it says twice in this psalm, he's no better than his dog. Verse 12, but man, despite his riches, does not endure. He is like the beasts that perish. Verse 20, a man who has riches without understanding is like the beasts that perish. Exactly the same destiny as his dog, the grave, the earth. So the rich man will take nothing with him when he dies. Verse 17, he will take nothing with him when he dies. His splendor will not descend with him. He'll leave it all behind. How much did he leave? Said somebody to a vicar who had just taken the funeral of a very wealthy millionaire, to which the vicar replied, everything. And this is what Paul says in the New Testament, 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 7. We brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. I remember reading once about a Christian prisoner who was a Japanese prisoner of war, and he was very badly beaten on almost a daily basis by his guard. And what got him through was that he deliberately made himself think of this man who was beating him as the man he was when he came into this world, a little tiny crying baby, absolutely helpless, totally dependent on his mother, somebody's son, baby son, and the man he will be when he dies, on his deathbed, scared, weak, frightened, just the same as everybody else. And this was the man who was beating him, and this is what got him through those beatings. Okay. Well, is there a solution to this rather depressing conclusion? Does the psalmist have a solution? Or is he just as powerless as the rich people he's condemning? Well, I hope he has a solution, because it's hardly worth writing a psalm and putting it to music and giving it a harp accompaniment if that's all he's got to say. And he does have a solution. And you'll find the solution in verse 15. Look at verse 15. But God. Aren't you glad to hear those words after what you heard so far this morning? You might have been saying to yourself, well, I didn't come to church on this lovely summer morning to hear all that. Well, that's why the psalmist gives you the first four verses, because we don't want to hear all this, but it's true. That's why he spends four verses telling us to listen, because the world doesn't want to hear this, and some of you didn't want to hear it this morning either. But it's true. But then he says in verse 15, but God. And that's what believers say in the face of death. They say, but God. But God. God will redeem my life from the grave. In other words, what he has just said, money can't do, God can do. God can redeem me, my soul, my life from the grave. He will surely take me to himself. No man has the power or the influence or the riches to redeem himself from the grave, but God has the power and the influence to redeem people from the grave. Verse 15, God will redeem my soul from the grave. We do insist on interpreting these words in a Greek way rather than a Hebrew way. By his soul, he simply means me. God will redeem me, my life, from the grave. Parallelism in the next line, he will surely take me to himself. So my soul, line 1, is me, line 2. God will redeem me from the grave. What death does to me, God will undo. What death God puts in the grave, God will bring out of the grave. Me, that includes my body. God can redeem me, rescue me from the grave. All that went in, God has the power to bring out. Verse 15, God will redeem my life from the grave. He will surely take me to himself. Well then, it seems to me that it's better and it's wiser to make sure that we know God and that we have a relationship with God and that we're pursuing God and seeking God and trusting God and boasting in God and hoping in God rather than spending our lives boasting and pursuing and trusting in riches, which in the end will prove absolutely worthless. Are you pursuing God as much as you're pursuing riches? Are you? Are you pursuing God? Are you seeking God? Are you seeking that relationship with God? Are you developing that relationship with God as much as you're pursuing and seeking riches? I hope you are, because your riches are going to let you down. But God can redeem you from the grave. And he will surely take me to himself. The word take there is exactly the same word as we find in Genesis chapter 5 where it says that Enoch was not because God took him. God took him. He walked with God. He had a relationship with God and therefore God took him. In that chapter 5, everybody dies. Everybody dies. Even though they live very, very, very long lives. And he died, and he died, and he died, and he died. But there's one glorious exception. It's Enoch who walked with God, and God took him. It probably means that he was the one great exception in that chapter to death. So God was even showing as early as then that death was not all powerful. It's the same word as we read in another similar psalm, Psalm 73. Just turn over to Psalm 73. Verse 24, you guide me with your counsel and afterwards you will take me into glory. You guide me with your counsel and afterwards you will take me into glory. Wonderful verse. So the ultimate destiny of God's people is not the grave. It's God. God will redeem my life from the grave. He will surely take me to himself. So what money can't do, God can do. So trust in God. Don't trust in money. Now the psalmist is unaware of how God will redeem his people from death. He is unaware of how costly the ransom would prove to be. To redeem is to liberate through the payment of a price. And the New Testament sheds much more light on this psalm. More light than the psalmist ever knew about. And there are two passages in the New Testament in particular which throw light onto this psalm. The first is Mark chapter 10 verse 45. The Lord Jesus Christ, as soon as he had been recognized by his disciples as the Christ, the Messiah, he goes to Jerusalem. He makes the journey to Jerusalem, and all the way to Jerusalem he's telling his disciples that he's going to die. And in chapter 10 verse 45 he says, "The Son of Man did not come to be served but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." Death is the wages of sin, you see. Death is what sin deserves. It's sin's wages. It's what sin has earned. So how can we who have earned death be redeemed from death? Only by the life and the death of another. And the Lord Jesus Christ, the King of Israel, the Son of God, went to Jerusalem to lay down his life to be the ransom for us. He died that we might be saved from death and redeemed from the grave. And another New Testament verse which throws light onto this is in 1 Peter chapter 1, where Peter says, "You were not redeemed with corruptible things like silver and gold, but with the precious blood of Christ." So what silver and gold could not do, the precious blood of Christ could do. Death is oblivious to money and to wealth, but faced by the precious blood of Christ, death can only give up its debt. The price is paid. Has it been accepted? Yes, it has, because Jesus has been raised from the dead. We began, thank you Steve, for starting with that Easter morning hymn. Isn't this a con, singing resurrection hymns only on Easter morning, one Sunday a year, when we should be singing resurrection hymns every Sunday? That's what Sunday's all about. It's the day on which Jesus rose. It's the day we celebrate the resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ. We should sing resurrection hymns every Sunday. Good move there, Steve. And the resurrection of Jesus means that the price has been accepted and death is dead. Love has won. Christ has conquered. Jesus told the story of a very rich man. He'd done really, really well. He was a sort of Robert Maxwell type. And he took early retirement. And he was looking forward to a long and wealthy retirement. He'd sorted his pension out very well. He pulled down his barns and built bigger ones. And he said, "Right, so," which of course means me. "Right, me," he says. "Eat, drink, take your ease. Time for an early retirement. Got a good pension here." And that night, that very night, God said to him, "Fool. Fool. Tonight, your soul, your life, you will be required." And he died. He was a fool. And he was a very prosperous, wealthy man. You know, he could have given you really good financial advice. He could have sorted out your pension. But he was a fool. An absolute fool. Why? Because he forgot God. And it's stupid to forget your Creator. He forgot he was going to die, which is daft. Because it's the most glaringly obvious thing. And he forgot the poor. He laid it all up for himself. And the God of the Bible is the God of the poor, who hates injustice and who hates ostentation when other people are suffering and dying needlessly. And therefore he was stupid. For those three reasons. Forgetting God, forgetting death, and forgetting the poor. "You fool," said God, "tonight your soul will be required of you." And therefore Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, "Do not lay up treasure on earth where moth and rust corrupt and where thieves break through and steal. It's not safe. It's not secure. Instead, lay up treasure in heaven where moth and rust do not corrupt and where thieves cannot break through and steal. Because where your treasure is, there your heart will be also."